When the worst of this is all over, we'll begin to reopen. But that process will not be cut and dried.
It's not about economics versus public health. It's that economics and public health need to be working together.
I'm Shamita Basu, in for Tanzina Vega. And for today on The Takeaway, May 4th, we're breaking down how or if we'll be able to go back to normal after the pandemic. Then, how leading Democrats have dismissed Tara Reid's sexual assault accusations against Joe Biden, and what it means for the Me Too movement.
Do they actually believe any of the things they wrote during the Kavanaugh hearing?
Also, a look at the high COVID-19 death rate in nursing homes and long-term care facilities, and then how the Navajo Nation is grappling with the virus with limited resources.
On the Navajo Nation, we are looking now at a pandemic on top of epidemics that we currently have.
Let's get to it. Across the country, states are starting to relax restrictions put in place due to COVID-19, even as the number of confirmed cases continues to climb and the death toll surpasses 67,000 people. Experts say the pandemic could go on for another 2 years, with subsequent waves of infection in the fall and winter. Still, that hasn't stopped places like Georgia and Texas from allowing businesses to reopen. On Friday, Governor Brian Kemp lifted the stay-at-home order for most of Georgia's residents, with an exception for people who are elderly or, quote, medically fragile, who are required to shelter in place through June 12th. We'll talk more about Georgia's reopening on this show in the coming days. And elsewhere in the country, stay-at-home orders are still going strong. But in states like California and Michigan, government officials are facing increasing backlash from protesters who want things to return to normal. So far, the protests have been limited in size, and people participating range from anti-vaccination activists to far-right extremists using the pandemic to push forward white supremacy. Still, these protests and the reopening process in general raise serious questions about when and how states should resume business as usual, and what happens if we reopen too soon. For more on this, we're joined by Caitlin Rivers, an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, and Jeremy Ude, global health politics expert and dean of the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Thank you both for coming on the program.
Thanks for the invitation.
Good to be here.
Caitlin, I think a lot of people hear reopen and think that means go completely back to normal. So what does reopening state by state mean to you?
That's right. Reopening is not going to be a light switch where one day we wake up and are able to do all of our normal activities. It's going to be a slow reincorporation of community activities back into our lives. And so we might start with things that are low risk, like more outdoor activities, maybe some essential shopping locations. The businesses that are asked to reopen first will vary state by state, but it certainly will not be all at once. And then as we take that first step and start to reincorporate those activities, if things go well, we can start to do more, and we will proceed like that slowly.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jeremy, a lot of the governors who are talking about reopening their states as quickly as possible keep saying that it's an economic necessity. How fair is it to be thinking of this as a sort of zero-sum game, economic health versus public health?
Well, I think if we frame it in that perspective, we actually lose out on the bigger picture here. It's not about economics versus public health. It's that economics and public health need to be working together. And so if we think about this in terms of, well, we have to do this for the economy, we're losing sight of the fact that if we reopen too quickly, what we're likely to do is to see another wave that comes later on in the year. And that wave could be as bad, if not worse, than what we're currently experiencing. So even though there are the pains right now that go along with having these restrictions in place, it's actually going to be better for us in the long run as opposed to opening up too quickly.
Caitlin, the federal government has released some guidelines on the reopening process, including the criteria to consider. And I've heard a lot of elected officials cite new cases per day as a meaningful metric when thinking about when to reopen. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yes, we do want to see the epidemic start to slow before we consider reopening. And keeping an eye on the number of new cases each day is one way to do that. Other metrics that are important are the number of people hospitalized, both currently and new hospitalizations each day, and the number of deaths. And again, those all help us to understand whether we are in the acceleration phase or whether our staying home to slow the spread has begun to break chains of transmission and slow the epidemic.
Mm-hmm. Caitlin, what are some of the approaches to reopening that we're seeing here in the U.S.? And as I mentioned earlier, Georgia was the first state to start doing this.
So there are decisions about what industries or what segments of the economy can reopen, and that does vary state by state. We've seen in Georgia that they are leisure activities, personal services. Other states have chosen to focus more on businesses. And so there are decisions that will vary about what will be allowed to reopen. But there's another side, which is what is the public health approach to keep the community safe during that reopening. And that side focuses really a lot on diagnostic testing and contact tracing. Those are the tools that will allow us to control transmission during that reopening process. And that second public health part is pretty widely understood, pretty widely shared among states. And again, that's diagnostic testing and contact tracing.
Yeah, so tell me where we stand on those two things right now. I know that Georgia has been saying in the past few days that they've pretty significantly ramped up testing, but that's also from a very low number of tests earlier. How are states doing on testing and contact tracing?
We have seen a pretty substantial expansion in our testing capacity. Last week, the United States ran about 1.6 million tests, which is a great improvement over what we saw even earlier in April, but it's still not to the level that many experts recommend. Recommendations range from about 3.5 million tests a week and go up from there. And so there is still more room to grow. And I think that's important to make sure that we're not just finding people with severe illness, but really everybody with COVID-like symptoms. And again, that's to enable the second piece, which is contact tracing. We have estimated, along with the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, that the U.S. will need about 100,000 additional contact tracers. And states have begun to make moves towards hiring those contact tracers. Again, this is happening at the state level, and so the movement to hire those varies from place to place. But there are efforts underway to expand our capacity to do that.
What kind of skill set do you need to be a contact tracer?
We recommend that contact tracers be familiar with the local community, and they need to be comfortable with conducting interviews and collecting data. It is a skilled position, but it's the kind of skill you can teach through maybe a day course or a couple day course, and so it's quite approachable. This is also a good opportunity to hire people who have not been able to work, perhaps because they've lost their job because of the pandemic.
Mm. Now, when we think about vaccines and therapeutics and the timelines for those, how does that factor into how states can think about their plans to reopen?
It's unlikely that we will have an effective therapeutic or vaccine in time to affect reopening plans. You probably heard in the news recently that a new product by Gilead is becoming an option for treatment, which is exciting, but that product is used late in the course of illness, so when people are already quite sick. In order for a therapeutic to be useful to break transmission and to influence the epidemiology, we need something earlier in the course of illness, and unfortunately, that's not available yet.
Jeremy, how much of a role is public pressure playing in reopening states, like what we're seeing with some of these protests, even though they're fairly small in scope?
Yeah, I think we can't underestimate the role that public pressure is playing. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that a lot of these protests that we have seen are actually other political movements that are glomming on to this. But in a lot of places, you are starting to see more of this public demonstration that's taking place, and governors are starting to feel pressure. And I think what's actually going to be really complicated about this or pose a lot of problems is that if we're going to do this sort of reopening, governors have to be willing to step that back. If the testing is showing that we are seeing an increase in the number of cases or the number of hospitalizations is going up, governors are going to have to be able to make that potentially difficult political choice to say, okay, I know we opened up businesses, but we need to close some of those back down because we're seeing too much community spread. And that's going to take a whole huge amount of political skill in order to be able to walk that back in the face of that potential political and public pressure.
Mm-hmm. Caitlin, what do we know about the best practices around easing out of a lockdown?
In terms of walking back restrictions, we don't have a great template because we are in a place we have never been before. We have never asked everyone to stay home before. And so the exact right moves, I think, are still a little bit uncertain. But we recommend that states start with low-risk activities. Again, those might be things that are outdoors, things where social distancing is very possible. Make those first few moves and see how things go, because it's much easier to pull back from low-risk activities that are unlikely to cause a great deal of transmission than to dive in with a mass gathering, for example, that might result in a lot of secondary cases. And then again, you are in a place where you have a lot of community transmission and you have created the conditions that led us all having to stay home in the first place. And so it's really about starting with low-risk activities and proceeding slowly.
Jeremy, what lessons can we learn from other countries that have already started the reopening process? You know, for example, I'm thinking about Singapore, and maybe you want to bring up other examples, but Singapore was praised as having handled things really well from the start. They were testing extensively, there was contact tracing happening there, but now the number of new cases per day is just shooting up there.
Yeah, you know, Singapore is a great example, I think, of the potential issues that can come up with this reopening, because as you pointed out, they received a lot of praise for their early and aggressive actions, but we are seeing the second wave of cases. And one of the things I think is really interesting about the Singapore case is that it is highlighting some of the existing social cleavages that exist within Singapore. So a lot of the new cases that are popping up in Singapore are happening among migrant workers who are oftentimes living in less than ideal conditions. And so it's reflecting some of these other sorts of social, political, and economic divisions that exist within society. So there are some issues there, but you know, we can look to countries like South Korea, which again, lots of testing, lots of contact tracing that has enabled these sorts of moves to be able to move forward. And we're seeing some real potentially positive signs coming out of Australia and New Zealand. Even earlier today, they were talking about how they're thinking about creating a travel bubble where people who are in Australia or New Zealand would be able to travel between the two countries, but there still might be restrictions for people coming from other places. But again, it's that ability to do the testing, the ability to do that contact tracing, and then the ability to use those data that are collected in order to inform the policymaking process that's going to be so incredibly vital for making this something that works.
Caitlin, here on The Takeaway, we've been talking about the disproportionate impact of the pandemic on low-income communities, on people of color, especially Black Americans. Should we assume that reopening too soon would only further impact these populations the most?
It's true that health disparities play out in so many different ways. So I think one of the key pieces of missing data right now is understanding where people are getting infected even during being asked to stay home. And I suspect that people who are still considered essential workers and participating in community activities are at higher risk. And those will largely be under-resourced communities, communities of color, low-wage workers. And so when we do reintroduce more community activities, it will be still those people at risk. And so I think it's really important that we understand how and why new cases are arising so that we can take additional steps to protect people in those settings. Underlying health conditions and other factors that put people at risk for infection and for severe illness, again, disproportionately affect under-resourced communities. And so I do think we will continue to see that show up in the epidemiology.
Dr. Caitlin Rivers is an epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. And Jeremy Yude is a global health politics expert and dean of the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Thank you both for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
It's been 1 month since Tara Reid, a former Senate staffer, publicly accused former Vice President Joe Biden of sexually assaulting her in 1993. In early April, two sources corroborated the details in her claims, and last week, two more sources came forward. Last Friday on MSNBC, Mika Brzezinski asked Joe Biden about the accusation.
Would you please go on the record with the American people? Did you sexually assault Tara Reid?
No, it is not true. I'm saying unequivocally, it never, never happened.
Joining us now is Rich McHugh, an investigative reporter and producer who has reported on Tara Reid's allegations for Business Insider. Rich, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Sarah Jones, staff writer for New York Magazine. She's written about what this case means for the feminist movement and 2020. Thank you for coming on the show, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rich, walk us through what Tara Reid has said publicly and what you've learned through your reporting so far.
So Tara Reid came out with an allegation a little over a year ago, actually. Her first allegation was that there was sexual harassment. That was in a small paper, I believe, called the Union in Northern California. A month ago, as you've set up, Tara came out on a podcast, Katie Halper's radio show, and accused Joe Biden of sexual assault. So now, all these years later, she's come forward and basically has said this is what happened. But a number of voices have come forward in corroborating parts of her story. One of them is a neighbor who I spoke with last week, who lived next to Tara in 1995 and 96, and said, look, she told me of this event in 1995. We were right next to each. We lived right next door to each other. And, you know, I found her voice compelling and believable because she says, look, I'm a lifelong Democrat. I will be voting for Joe Biden. But I know Tara. She's a good person. You need to understand this happened. And that's the reason I'm coming forward.
Yeah, I want to come back to what that neighbor had to say to you in a few minutes. But Sarah, it's no secret that many people have seen Joe Biden as a complicated figure, to say the least, way long before Reid came forward about her alleged assault. And now that he's cleared the path to the nomination, he has promised that his running mate will be a woman. Can you sort of characterize his track record on women's issues?
You know, Biden had built up a lot of goodwill over the years, thanks to the Violence Against Women Act, which he helped write. He was a notable voice addressing the subject of campus sexual assault, but he was still a complicated figure, as you know, due primarily to his handling of Anita Hill's testimony during Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearings. And also on abortion rights, Biden supported the Hyde Amendment, which bans the use of public funds for abortion until his most recent campaign for president. So a bit of a mixed bag there, at least from a feminist perspective.
Rich, one question that came up during Biden's MSNBC interview on Friday was about the complaint that Tara Reid says she filed at the time. And Biden says that this document would be in the National Archives if it exists. But you actually reached out to the National Archives. What did you learn from them?
So I reached out to the National Archives and they said, no, that document would not exist there. They have no such document. I mean, according to her, if she filed, it was with an office called the Fair Employment Practices Office. And so that was the question we had asked, said, you know, if there were a complaint filed at that office, would it be in the National Archives? And they said no. So that's why there's this renewed focus on the University of Delaware and his senatorial papers.
And is there any way to unseal those documents there at the University of Delaware? Or is that something that Joe Biden would have to okay himself?
I believe it's the latter. We've tried. I've filed a FOIA request, and apparently senatorial papers and congressional stuff like that is immune to a FOIA request.
And if you were able to foil for that kind of stuff, I mean, what are you hoping to find there? What else are you hoping to find there?
Well, a way to prove or disprove this happened. You know, if there was a document that she had filed, if there was a complaint, what does it say? Does she say what she's saying happened? And if that document exists still, it would answer a lot of questions. You know, Tara also said she went through the proper protocols and up the chain of command, telling people, her supervisors, she felt uncomfortable. She felt harassment over this certain issue before the assault. And so she said those people were taking notes. So where are those notes? If they still exist, that would shed a lot of light on this whole conversation.
Do you have an understanding of whether Tara Reid filed a complaint about the details about this alleged sexual assault, or was it about this number of complaints leading up to it?
From my understanding, it's not about the assault from everything she said to me. It's about the events leading up to it and what she was feeling at the time.
Right. So in terms of corroborating the actual events of that day, what is Tara hoping will be out there to support her claims?
Well, that's a good question. I don't really know the answer to it. I only know that as a reporter, I'm trying to find other people who can say, you know, yes, I remember, you know, I worked in that office and this happened, or, you know, I worked in this office and she told me just the opposite, you know, or whatever. But, you know, we're just trying to do our job and find more people who can shed light one way or another.
Rich, in your reporting, you spoke to an old neighbor of Tara's who says that she remembers hearing about this alleged incident in the mid-1990s, and she believes in telling the truth. She also said that she is a Democrat who plans to vote for Biden. Sarah Jones from New York Magazine, what do you make of that?
It's interesting. It doesn't surprise me all that much. I think it makes a great deal of sense to believe that Joe Biden did do this, but also consider him against the person of Donald Trump, who's been accused of sexual assault and harassment by so many women. And despite everything, that Biden might be the lesser of two evils.
Rich, Biden claimed in his interview with MSNBC last week that two major papers show that Reid's allegations are not credible. And Stacey Abrams, who is a potential vice presidential pick for Biden, was asked about this on CNN last Thursday. Let's listen to her.
I believe that women deserve to be heard, and I believe that they need to be listened to. But I also believe that those allegations have to be investigated by credible sources. The New York Times did a deep investigation, and they found that the accusation was not credible. I believe Joe Biden.
That's Stacey Abrams speaking there. Rich McHugh, what do you make of what she's saying there about the New York Times investigation?
Well, I think it's slightly disingenuous to point to that and say they concluded their investigation, because after I came forward with my piece with two more on the record sources, both the Times and the Washington Post put out new stories and added their voices to their reporting. And so, you know, I have to imagine that the reporters at the Times and the Washington Post would never say they concluded their investigation. And I certainly have not.
Sarah, you wrote in a recent piece that Tara Reid has given public feminists an ideological test, and many are failing. What do you mean by that?
Do they actually believe any of the things they wrote during the Kavanaugh hearings or before that, as Me Too first gained public momentum and you took down figures like Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose, and liberal figures like Al Franken? It seems to me that, you know, some people viewed the story of Brett Kavanaugh in particular and saw Christine Blasey Ford's allegations about him as though that they were principally a story about the hypocrisy of Republican men or of conservative Christian men, and viewed it through an electoral lens, when in fact what people had been saying about Me Too is that, you know, this is a story about power and how it gets abused by people who wield it. And that seems to me something that some public feminists are forgetting in the wake of Tara Reid's allegations about Joe Biden.
And Sarah, looking forward to the presidential election later this year, at risk of simplifying it, I mean, what's a feminist to do?
It's a terrible position. It is absolutely the worst position for a feminist to be in. And I don't think that there's a simple resolution to it at all. You know, what I was really trying to get at my piece is that sense of exhaustion and frustration, the idea that you are continually cleaning up after men like Joe Biden who have such complicated legacies. And by the time Tara Reid came forward, she had already accused Biden of sexual harassment, and she was by no means the only one who'd accused him of some version of boundary violating behavior. This is not an ideal situation. You know, I think that there's some credibility to the argument that given what the alternative is, women have to vote for him anyway. But I do think that this should be, really a cause for reckoning with the movement about what we're willing to settle for from the Democratic Party.
Sarah Jones is a staff writer for New York Magazine, and Rich McHugh is an investigative reporter and producer at Business Insider. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Shamita Basu. A disproportionately high number of COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. have been linked to long-term care facilities like nursing homes and assisted living communities. Now, a new estimate from USA Today shows more than 16,000 deaths have been linked to nursing homes and long-term care facilities. Elaine Godfrey, reporter for The Atlantic, was reporting on why the death toll has been so high at long-term care centers when her own grandmother died at a facility in Minnesota. Elaine, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And let me just say first, I'm really very sorry for your loss. Can you tell us about what happened to your grandmother?
Yeah, thank you for saying that. So my grandmother was 94 years old. She lived in Minnesota at an assisted living facility, and she had for several years. We didn't know that she was sick. She was dizzy and fell down one night and went to the hospital. And at the hospital, they tested her for coronavirus. A few days later, it turned out that she had it. But otherwise, she had no fever at first anyway, and she didn't have other respiratory symptoms, really. It was really surprising to us. You know, it was really fast. She died within just a few days of her fall.
Oh, I'm so very sorry. Now, I know that this is very personal for you, but you also have done some reporting on this now, and you've been talking to experts and other families. Is this a typical experience?
I think it's a typical experience in the speed of it. Elderly people show different symptoms. There have been some studies that have shown that elderly people show atypical symptoms. So they don't necessarily have a fever. They don't necessarily have these respiratory symptoms that we're seeing. So their symptoms sort of run the gamut. And I think it's important for people to know that. The thing that is in common across the board is just the speed with which people become sick. Someone that I talked with in Virginia at a nursing home in Richmond, Virginia, told me as she was sort of working the floors, people would show, you know, signs of general illness or fatigue, and then very, very quickly become bedridden, immediately lose their ability to move around by themselves, and they'd have to be sent to the hospital. So it was very, very common that within just a few days, this disease took hold.
Can you give us a sense of the real scope of this? Like we said at the top that at least 16,000 coronavirus deaths have been linked to long-term care facilities. Is that accurate?
It's almost certainly an undercount because we don't have the numbers. We haven't tested everyone. We are not sure at this point who's actually died of the virus or complications related to the virus. In Minnesota, where my grandmother lived, some 70% of all coronavirus deaths in the state have been linked to nursing homes and assisted living. In six other states, which again, it could be more because not all states have reported their total numbers, but in six other states, at least half of their coronavirus deaths are residents and workers at these places. The scope of this is just enormous.
You say it's not just about the health of that population. It also has to do with underinvestment in these types of facilities. Can you talk about that and what you've reported on?
A lot of the nursing homes that are really struggling right now, they have a lot of patients paying through Medicaid. Medicaid reimburses these facilities at a pretty low rate compared to insurance most of the time or private pay. So these facilities aren't necessarily breaking even on the care that they're providing for people. Another part of this underinvestment is that many of these facilities are privately owned, and sometimes the owners, you know, any money that the facility is able to make, that money is used to pay shareholders. Basically, this underfunding means often these facilities are short on staff. Often residents have to share rooms and bathrooms, which is not a great way to prevent infection spread. A lot of these facilities are struggling with a lack of PPE, personal protective equipment, the kind of thing you have to wear when you're going room to room to room every day with these very, very vulnerable people.
Elaine, I want to turn to the question of people working in these facilities. Who are they and what are they facing?
The majority of workers who make up staff at these nursing homes and assisted living facilities are certified nursing assistants. These are people who bathe patients, feed them, take care of their daily needs. They are some of the lowest paid healthcare workers in America. Most make less than $15 an hour. They're mostly women. Often they're immigrants, and many live in multi-generational homes. They are taking care of older parents who are similarly vulnerable, or young children. They're working multiple jobs. They might work at multiple nursing homes. They might have totally different jobs, but it means either way that they're being exposed to this virus at other places and potentially bringing it into the building. So all of these factors sort of combine to make a really, really deadly scenario for these residents and for staff.
Mm. In your piece, you also raise the issue of testing and how proper testing could have dramatically reduced the spread of the virus, especially in these types of facilities. And this is something that we've talked about in general a lot on this show, but can you explain what you mean specifically in the context of nursing homes and long-term care?
So we knew before this virus hit the U.S. that the elderly were most vulnerable and that asymptomatic people could likely spread the virus. So we knew those two things. Yet the CDC here in the U.S. prioritized hospital patients and healthcare workers who showed symptoms to get tests over nursing home residents who were symptomatic and over people who didn't show symptoms but might work or live in these high-risk places. The CDC announced that they're sort of switching up their priorities. So now they include nursing home residents and workers with symptoms as high priority. But either way, healthcare policy experts that I spoke with said this is all wrong. It doesn't really help. They want there to be universal testing. So they're saying test everyone in these facilities. Why from the beginning did we not send tests to these facilities and require that all workers and all residents take them regardless of symptoms, since they're such hotspots and since there have been so many fatalities in these places?
Was it an issue of bad prioritization from the beginning, or were there not enough tests?
Definitely both. Our big issue in this country with the response to this virus has been we don't have enough tests. We did not ramp up testing quickly or quickly enough. So the CDC definitely had to make a hard choice there, right? How do we prioritize what limited supply we have? But experts say we knew that the quote unquote death traps would be nursing homes and assisted living facilities where people can't leave, where they live in close proximity, where they're already immunocompromised or frail. So they're saying it was just a big mistake to begin with. And they're saying that it emphasizes or reveals our pre-existing disregard for older people in this country. That was a big point that all of these experts continued to make to me.
You mentioned this recent change in prioritization for testing. Have we seen any other changes, or are there any on the horizon at the state or federal level?
The Trump administration is doing their best to invest more money in rapid tests for residents and workers of nursing homes. So we know that. The governor of Maryland issued an executive order telling all nursing homes to test everyone. So advocates are really happy about that. They say it could be too little too late. But, you know, if every governor said that, let's prioritize these nursing homes, we could really stop a lot of these deaths.
Elaine, what do you want people to take away from your reporting and from your very personal story that you've shared here about your grandmother?
I guess I'd say that we are all worried about contracting this virus, our loved ones contracting this virus. I would say that we should all spare a thought for the nursing home residents, assisted living residents, and workers who are quite literally, you know, at the epicenter of this crisis. They are really in quite a fragile state right now. If we could spare a thought for them, send some meals, some extra PPE their way. And going forward, I think we should think about how we prioritize these vulnerable people, people who are our parents and our grandparents.
Elaine Godfrey is a reporter at The Atlantic. Elaine, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we've been hearing from some of you who work in long-term care facilities or who have family working in one.
Hey, I'm calling from New York. My name is Dee. My sister works at a long-term care facility, and the level of disrespect that they've been seeing towards not only the workers but also the patients is just atrocious. They've had times where they have had multiple deaths, 5, 6, 7, 8 deaths within a 24-hour period. People have been out sick with COVID symptoms. No one has said anything to them and allowed them to still get sick. PPE has not been provided to them. The administrators say nothing. They still have yet to say thank you to the staff or show any kind of appreciation for the dedication that these people are doing and the harm that they're putting themselves into. It is beyond belief.
Hi, this is Linda calling from West Palm Beach. I have a sister in Atlanta, Georgia, who works as a physical therapist in senior living facility. Her patient was diagnosed with COVID-19. She was alerted and had to take a test. My sister's initial test came back positive. She had to pay $165 for that test, has filed a workman's comp claim. 2 subsequent tests proved that she is negative. So 3 tests total, and she is no longer working. Thank you.
Nurses at long-term care facilities develop close relationships with their patients and their families. It is gut-wrenching for them to lose their patients like this. When my sister was sick, she repeatedly blamed herself and thought that she was a failure. But she's so far from a failure. She's been fighting through impossible odds to help as many people as she can to be healthy and safe. Everyone needs to support her and her colleagues in arms by staying home and staying healthy. This virus is not a joke, and it should not be taken lightly. My name is Maggie, and I'm calling from Morris County, New Jersey.
Tell us your experience working in a nursing home or assisted living facility. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. While densely populated states like New York and New Jersey have been hit hard by COVID-19, the area with the third highest infection rate in the country is the largely rural Navajo Nation, according to NPR. To date, the Navajo Department of Health has reported more than 2,300 confirmed cases of coronavirus and more than 70 deaths out of nearly 12,000 tests. In order to understand why the Navajo Nation has been hit so disproportionately, it's important to look at the broader healthcare picture for the tribe. Decades of federal underfunding of the Indian Health Service have resulted in understaffed and under-resourced medical providers, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture considers most of the Navajo Nation a food desert due to a limited number of grocery stores and access to fresh produce.
On the Navajo Nation, we are looking now at a pandemic on top of epidemics that we currently have. We have the highest rates of diabetes and heart-related, food-related diseases, and this is something that has been an issue pre-COVID.
That's Denisa Livingston, a tribal Diné citizen. Diné is the name that Navajo Nation members use for their tribe. Denisa is a community health advocate with the Diné Community Advocacy Alliance, as well as the Slow Food International Indigenous Counselor of the Global North. I spoke with her to get a better sense of what grassroots efforts to combat COVID-19 look like on the Navajo Nation. And she began by telling me about the work being done to get food and water to tribal citizens currently in need.
We see donations coming in, including water supplies, PPEs, and food. And that has been a very challenging coordination of reaching all of our citizens across 3 states as we're looking at the size of a place like West Virginia and trying to channel in and also help those that are greatest in need in the remote areas of the Diné Nation. And some projects that have also continued to operate is the water project. It's called Dig Deep. And 1/3 of our Diné people do not have a sink or a toilet. And also 1/3 do not have everyday water access. And so they're hauling water. And even in this case, they pay about 67 times more for water that they haul versus pipe water. And so when we're looking at the food access and the water access, it is a critical urgency and cry out to be able to try to meet the needs of our people.
Denisa, are you seeing efforts to build trust between health officials and Navajo Nation leaders and members during this pandemic?
Of course, I cannot speak, you know, on behalf of the tribal government and also the healthcare facilities as a concerned tribal member and also a community health advocate, it is very concerning that the narratives that we see and the stories and the and what we're going through in families and what they're experiencing do not match the numbers that we see. We know that there is under testing. We know that there's a lack of transparency, even when we're speaking about the asymptomatic terms. Some of our folks have called and messaged and emailed and said, what does that mean? The terminology is also not out there, the public health education that should be. Of course, our tribe and our community members have been creating culturally sensitive PSAs and announcements regarding this, but really understanding the depth of COVID-19 and how the symptoms operate and also how the virus mutates. And I know that folks are doing what they can, but we still need to be able to engage the community at large when it comes to public health education.
Yeah, tell me more about the public health messaging, particularly in regards to being culturally sensitive. What does the messaging look like to connect to your community members right now?
So some of the messages are in our Dene language, and also some of the messages are geared towards protecting our elders. As we know, they are very precious to us, and as we know that they're the knowledge holders and wisdom barriers. And so there is that question, you know, how do we, you know, protect them in a way that the community members, the family members know exactly, you know, how to navigate that process. Washing hands is also a concern when it comes to this situation, because washing hands is also affecting the cultural practice that we have of acknowledging each other by shaking hands and finding ways that we don't show disrespect. And before we were fist bumping and also elbow bumping, but now, you know, just allowing our community members to know that it's not out of disrespect that we can't shake hands, but let's be mindful and also honor one another's presence in a way that, you know, that we're honoring one another without shaking hands has also been something that people have been talking about. But also some of the other terms too that we're trying to bring awareness at DCAA are the terms of self-isolation. I think we have to be mindful of when we use these terms of what self-isolation means, self-quarantine, and quarantine in remote areas. As we know, these are just recommendations. And this also goes, you know, for my grandmother. My grandma lives in remote Dene area, and I spoke with her the other day. And she said, you know, we're told to stay inside our house. And she said, I've just been staying inside. When my grandma's, you know, so active, she's outside, she's normally planting, she's normally taking care of the seeds. And at this time, you know, doing that effort. The second time I called her to check on her, I said, how are you doing? She said, we're still staying inside. So the messaging that's coming from the top down as well needs to be in a way where, yes, it applies in most situations, but what about when my grandma or other community members have neighbors that are not, you know, a few feet away or down the hallway, but are, you know, miles or even space in a way where, you know, they don't have that contact with one another. So I told her, grandma, it's, you know, it's okay to plant your seeds. It's okay to get outside. And so really looking at these terms as we're looking at different cultures and of course, you know, here in the U.S., you know, there are many cultures and many practices as we are heeding, you know, to the CDC's recommendations or recommendations coming from the top down. But what are those messaging? What are those things to improve our ways and practices to be proactive rather than being reactive at this time, and to scale impact from the community members' perspective, and also, you know, in solidarity and in collaboration and partnership with one another about overcoming the place that we are at right now.
Denisa Livingston is a tribal Dene citizen and community health advocate with the Dene Community Advocacy Alliance. Denisa, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
That's all for us today. Thank you so much for joining us. We want to let you know that we'll be staying on a few stories all week long. Following our conversation today about long-term care facilities, we'll look at the effects of extended isolation on the elderly, many of whom are battling the health effects of loneliness at this moment. And we'll keep talking about what it means to, quote, reopen the U.S. by zooming in on Georgia's efforts and asking what we can learn from past pandemics, too. Plus, we'll hear from you about how you think daily life will have changed when the worst of all of this is behind us.
I probably won't go to the grocery store every day.
I think one thing we'll keep is to have less structure for the kids weekends especially. It saves a lot of money too.
Share your take on this or anything else by leaving a message at 8778-MY-TAKE or by sending us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Shamitha Basu, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.